Welcome to this edition of Back to Basics with Pastor Brian Broderson.
Israel bore very little resemblance to what it had when the last of the prophets had spoken 400 plus years earlier. So it's a completely different place, and the history has just been crazy, full of intrigue and power plays and murder and civil wars and all of this horrible, horrible stuff.
Today on Back to Basics, Pastor Brian begins his study in the Gospel of Luke. Join us as Pastor Brian begins this series with his teaching on Luke chapter 1, verses 1 through 38. Now, here's Pastor Brian.
So let's jump in to the Gospel of Luke. But I realized as I was thinking about Luke, I realized that, of course, the Old Testament ends with the book of Malachi. But I realize we make a huge mistake if we think that there's a smooth, clear transition from Malachi to the Gospels. Because there were 400 years between the end of the Old Testament as we know it and the beginning of the New Testament. And as you end the Old Testament, the situation for the Jewish people at the end of the Old Testament is nothing like it is at the beginning of the New Testament. So, I mean, you can only imagine, right? In 400 years, just imagine all of the things that can take place. And everyone acknowledges, even the Jews themselves, acknowledge that during this 400 years, sometimes it's called the 400 silent years, there is the recognition that there was no prophetic voice during this period of time. So lots of things happen. But Malachi is the last person that spoke with the authority of Yahweh, until we come to John the Baptist. But during that period of time, so many things happened that changed the landscape of what Israel was like, and therefore greatly affected the people. So what I want to do is I want to start out by giving us a little bit of a journey from the end of the Old Testament period to the beginning of the New Testament. So, as I've said, Malachi closes the Old Testament canon, written approximately 450 BC or somewhere thereabouts. And at that time, most of the Israelites that had been led away captive by the Assyrians, now remember, there were two kingdoms that had developed after the time of Solomon. There's the Northern Kingdom, and then there's the Southern Kingdom. Northern Kingdom is known primarily as Israel or Ephraim. The Southern Kingdom is known as Judah. So in 721 BC, the Assyrians came and basically destroyed Israel for their sin and led those people from those 10 tribes, led them off into captivity. And some remained in the land, some came back to the land, but they dismantled the monarchy and basically dispersed the people. Now, the situation with Judah was different. After the Babylonian captivity, so 721 BC is the Assyrians, and more than 100 years later, the Babylonians come and they conquer Judah. So they began their siege in 607. They destroyed the temple in 586. And then in 538, approximately 538, large numbers of Jews returned to Judah under the Persian rulers. They rebuilt first the temple, and then the city was rebuilt. And these are the names of the people that were involved at that time: Zerubbabel, Haggai, Zechariah, Ezra, Nehemiah. They're all associated with this period of the return to Judah and of the rebuilding of the temple and the city. So under the Persians, once Jerusalem was reestablished, the people lived in relative peace and prosperity for about 100 years. Then came the Greeks. Then came Alexander the Great. And when Alexander conquered Persia, he began the process of Hellenizing the empire, which included Jerusalem and Israel. So Hellenization is the imposition of Greek culture upon non-Greek societies. So Alexander wanted the whole world to remind him of his homeland. And so he went about this process of Hellenization. And so lands were conquered, cities were founded with features that reflected Alexander's homeland: theaters, gymnasiums, schools, a municipal government. A universal monetary currency was established. Above all, Greek became the new language of a new world that united the cultures of Mesopotamia, Egypt, and the Mediterranean. Literature, commerce, medicine, religion, philosophy, and mathematics, as well as other fields, used Greek. Greek became the lingua franca. The Greek influence continued to spread even after the untimely death of Alexander in 323, and that influence spread through those who had carried on the empire after him. The empire was divided up between four of his generals. Two of them are very relevant to Israel because one of those powers was in the north, up in the area of Syria, and the other was in the south in Egypt. And so the Ptolemies ruled from Egypt. And the last Ptolemaic queen was Cleopatra. So the Ptolemies, Ptolemy is spelled the P is silent, P-T-O-L-E-M-A-I-S, the plural, Ptolemies. So the Ptolemies ruled the region, including Israel, from Alexandria in Egypt for the next 122 years, from 320 to 198. This was, again, a relatively peaceful time for the Jews and Jerusalem, with the exception of the Hellenization. So Hellenization at this point wasn't forced through any military type of activity. It was just the culture was just being radically influenced by Greek thoughts and ideas. So among the Jews, Hellenization increased. So great was the Greek-speaking population among the Jews that there was eventually the need for the scriptures to be translated into the Greek language. And so this is where we get what is called the Septuagint. British people pronounce it Septuagint. I heard an American and a British person the other day, they're talking, and one's saying Septuagint, the other's saying Septuagint, and then they kind of stopped and said, we say this differently, don't we? And it's like, yeah, that's a different pronunciation. But Septuagint, and you will see sometimes in your Bible, you might see a little side note that says it's LXX, and LXX are the Roman numerals for 70. And Septuagint means 70. So the legend, nobody knows exactly how accurate this is, but the legend is that the scriptures were translated by 70 scholars And here's where it seems like it's kind of legendary, in 72 days. Now, the interesting thing, though, is the Septuagint was produced in Alexandria, and it was paid for by King Ptolemy Philadelphus. So this is how good the Jews had it, in one sense, at this time. The king is the one who's paying to have the scriptures put into the Greek language. Now, in 198, everything suddenly shifts. In the north, you have the Seleucids. Now, they're all Greeks. So the Seleucids are Greeks, the Ptolemies are Greeks, and the other two generals that divided up the rest of Alexander's empire. So everybody's Greek. But unlike the Ptolemies, the Seleucids are much more oppressive. And so they took power from the Ptolemies over Judea and Jerusalem. So there was a bit of a war between these Greek states, one in the north and one in the south. In 168, their king, Antiochus IV, also known as Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus IV, he once again was attacking, or on his way to attack the Egyptian, the Ptolemies, and he was stopped in his tracks by the Romans. The Romans are just kind of coming onto the scene at this point in this part of the world. And in a failed effort to increase his hold on Egypt, Antiochus is forced by Rome to head back home. And as he returns home, he passes through Jerusalem, where he met a Jewish rebellion with brutal retaliation. So here's where things start to go bad for the Jews. He sacked the city, tore down its walls, looted the temple treasury. He made decrees prohibiting temple festivals and religious ceremonies such as circumcision. It became illegal to possess the Jewish scriptures. The worship of the Greek gods became mandatory, and soon festivals for the god Dionysus could be seen in Jerusalem streets. In the winter of 167, the temple was turned over to the worship of Zeus. And for 3 years, Greeks sacrificed pigs on Israel's holy altar. For 3 years. As a result, there was a revolt among the Jews. The Hasidim, as they were called. The Hasidim means the pious ones. These are the ancestors of the Pharisees. This is where the mention of the Hasidims is where, or Hasidims is where you will start to understand, if you trace, you'll start to understand who the Pharisees are. So they were led by a priest named Mattathias and his sons. And they rose up in opposition to Antiochus's forces in what is known as the Maccabean Revolt. So these Hasidim under Mattathias, they become known as the Maccabees. One of the sons of Mattathias, Judas, becomes identified as Judas Maccabeus, which means Judas the Hammer. And so they succeed in driving out Antiochus's forces. And in 164, December of 164, they liberate and they cleanse the temple. Now, December of 164. That event is remembered since then in the celebration of Hanukkah. So if you've known Jewish people over the years and you've wondered, like, around Christmas time. What, you know, what is this holiday that they're celebrating? This is what they're celebrating. They're celebrating the cleansing of the temple and the restoring of the worship. In the New Testament, John chapter 10, this is known as the Feast of Dedication because they rededicated the temple. So from the Maccabees, so this was a good thing, obviously, to liberate them from the wickedness of Antiochus. But from the Maccabees arose a line of priest kings. So Mattathias died in battle, Judas died in battle, the other brothers died in battle. There was one of the Hasmonean family left, and he became the new high priest. And when they anointed him as the high priest, they declared him a high priest forever. Now, this is where an interesting thing begins to take place, because what's happening with the Hasmonean dynasty, which arises from the Maccabees, is that they ultimately seek to replace the Davidic monarchy and rule the nation permanently. Now, keep that in mind. And they become very, very dominant. They are mostly corrupt in the beginning. Their motives, of course, were pure, but they became corrupted. Their corruption largely centered around their lust for power. They would conquer and impose harsh Jewish rule over the region of the Decapolis, which is just east of Israel and north, including the city of Damascus, which is in modern-day Syria, the same city, and the cities of the Decapolis. So they imposed this rigid, harsh Jewish rule upon them. And they were constantly warring among themselves, plotting, scheming, and even murdering one another. And this lasted until the Romans, under Pompey, came and subjugated them in 63 BC. So we often think about the 70 AD, where the Romans come and they destroy Jerusalem. Well, in 63 BC, Pompey comes, and he doesn't destroy Jerusalem entirely, but he teaches them basically a lesson and subjugates Israel under Roman power. So even under Roman power, the Hasmoneans still continued to rule until the time of Herod the Great. So now here we are. We're at the time of Herod the Great. Luke's going to mention Herod here in a moment. Now, Herod was an Idumean. And the Idumeans are also known as the Edomites. So remember, the Edomites were the descendants of Esau. And remember, Esau is the brother of Jacob. So these people are related to each other. So Herod is an Edomite, but he's married to a Hasmonean princess. He's married to a Hasmonean princess, and he is made king over Judea. So now he pushes back against the Hasmoneans, who are seeking, because they've merged the priesthood and the monarchy together, which was never to be done, and they're seeking to maintain that control. But Herod, of course, has more power. He's backed by the Romans. So he pushes them out, and Rome declares him king over Judea. And this all happened through the instrumentation of a person that you will also remember this name, Mark Antony. So Mark Antony is Herod's good friend. And Mark Antony says, you know, we got the perfect person to rule down in Judea. Herod needs to be the ruler. And the Romans voted on it and decided, okay, that's what it will be. And so my point in sharing all of this is that Israel bore very little resemblance to what it had when the last of the prophets had spoken 400 plus years earlier. So it's a completely different place, and the history has just been crazy, full of intrigue and power plays and murder and civil wars and all of this horrible, horrible stuff. Daniel chapter 11 gives us the prophetic picture of what's going to happen. It's kind of hard to track with it, but when you know some of this history, you start to see like, oh, this is what is being talked about here. So, but here's the good news. Even though, and of course, this is, has to do with all of the leaders of the nation, the hierarchy and so forth. You know, whenever you read a history of any country, nobody's going to write a history about you or me. They're going to write about the people in power, the people who had influence and all of that. And so all of this stuff that we're talking about, all of this was happening with the people who were in power. But there were the common people that were living through all of this political insanity. And there was a remnant among the common people whose hearts longed for deliverance. There's a remnant among the common people, and it is to these that the good news is about to come. That's what's happening now. The Lord is once again breaking forth into Israel's national life, and he's about to reveal himself once again in a way that nobody has experienced for this long, long period of time. And so that brings us to Luke. Now, Luke, we know certain things about Luke from Scripture. According to something Paul said in Colossians chapter 4, it seems that Luke was a Gentile. It seems that he was a Gentile because Paul mentions the Jewish workers that are with him, and Luke's not included in that, and then Luke is mentioned a few verses later. So, although it's not absolutely certain, it's probably the case that Luke was not a Jew, that he was a Gentile. He was a traveling and ministry partner of Paul. So, in Acts chapter 16, when Paul and his team are going to go from Trophimus to Macedonia, all of a sudden, the writing switches from they to we. Luke is the writer. So what we know is that Luke is part of the team at that point. Was he part of the team before? We don't know.
Let's join Pastor Brian in the studio as he shares about this month's resource from Back to Basics.
Hi, Pastor Brian here, and it is almost Christmas. And of course, this is a time of year when everybody is aware of this holiday. They're hearing Christmas music as they're out shopping, and yet not everyone knows what Christmas is truly all about. So we have a great offer for you for this month. It's a small book, and it's entitled, Is Christmas Unbelievable? It's written by Rebecca McLaughlin, who is an excellent writer and has so many good things to say here. Really a great little book to give to a friend, a neighbor, a family member at this time of the year. So I would encourage you to pick up your copy of Is Christmas Unbelievable by Rebecca McLaughlin.
Again, this month's resource is a book titled, Is Christmas Unbelievable? Four Questions Everyone Should Ask About the World's Most Famous Story by Rebecca McLaughlin. You can order the book, Is Christmas Unbelievable, by going to our website, backtobasicsradio.com. Scroll down until you see the photo of it, and then click on the donate button. When you give a gift to Back to Basics, we'll send you the book, Is Christmas Unbelievable? 4 questions everyone should ask about the world's most famous story by Rebecca McLaughlin to help equip you to defend the faith. It's our way of saying thank you for your generous support of this ministry. We'd also like to remind you that all of our other resources are waiting for you at backtobasicsradio.com or by calling our request line at 1-800-733-6443. That's 1-800-733-6443. Our desire is to encourage you in your daily walk with God. We'll continue tomorrow with more valuable insights from Pastor Brian as we study together in the Gospel of Luke. Back to Basics is the preaching and teaching ministry of Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, California.